From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, making hit TV shows, we talk with Grant Tinker. He co-founded MTM Enterprises, creating such shows as The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Hill Street Blues. Then Tinker headed NBC, pulling it out of its ratings slump. Patrice Gaines is a Washington Post reporter who sees herself in some of the young girls she writes about, like the teenage mothers lining up to visit their boyfriends in jail. Gaines not only visited her boyfriend in jail when she was young, she did time for possession of heroin. We'll talk about how she turned her life around. It's the subject of her new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The Muslim-led government in Bosnia says it no longer wants the international arms embargo to be lifted immediately. Bosnian Muslim President Alija Izetbegovic is expected to explain the thinking behind this major shift in his government's position during a speech at the United Nations today. The BBC's Kathy Jenkins reports.
The address by President Izetbegovic will formalize what has been said privately for weeks, that the lifting of the arms embargo now would not help the Bosnian government side. There are several calculations involved. Firstly, the determination of the countries providing peacekeepers to pull their troops out. Secondly, an acknowledgement that the Bosnian side could suffer an onslaught from the Bosnian Serbs before its troops got hold of heavy weapons, let alone regrouped and reformed to be able to use them. Why allow this, the argument goes, when some arms are coming in anyway and time can be taken to prepare for offensives to win back territory? The deferral of action would certainly let President Clinton off the hook. It would also prevent yet another major split in international policy towards Bosnia.
Kathy Jenkins reporting. The Pentagon says an American soldier was found dead of a gunshot wound in Haiti today, and officials think he committed suicide. The soldier is identified only as a member of the 10th Mountain Division from Fort Drum, New York. He's the first U.S. fatality during the occupation. Congress won't vote this year on legislation expanding health insurance to more Americans, but if one senator has his way, members may be forced to vote on whether to keep their own taxpayer-funded health plans. Julie Rovner reports.
Senator Harris Wofford, the Pennsylvania Democrat whose surprise 1991 election fueled the health care debate, says it's not fair for Congress to have publicly subsidized coverage when some 39 million Americans have none at all. Wofford says he'll try to force a Senate vote on a bill that would require members of Congress to pay the full costs of their health insurance. Currently, members of the House and Senate, like other federal employees, have roughly 70% of their insurance costs paid by taxpayers. Under Wofford's bill, if Congress did not act to guarantee insurance to all Americans within 18 months, members would lose their health coverage altogether. The measure is not expected to pass, but it could come up when the Senate considers a bill to ban gifts from lobbyists. For National Public Radio, I'm Julie Rovner in Washington.
Employees have gone on strike at the General Motors Buick City Complex in Flint, Michigan. They want GM to hire more workers and limit its use of outside contractors. GM says new hires might have to be laid off before long. The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee has ended its meeting without announcing any increase in interest rates. In stock trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 12 points in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down nearly 1 point. This is NPR News. Federal health officials are warning people arriving in the United States from the plague region in India to see a doctor if they develop symptoms. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also is preparing to issue a health advisory for American travelers heading to India. Officials say pneumonic plague has killed at least 50 people in Surat, India, but unofficial counts have been as high as 300. New cases of plague were reported today in New Delhi and Calcutta, both of which are far from Surat. People fleeing Surat are believed to be spreading the disease, which is curable with antibiotics. Republican candidates gathered on the Capitol steps today to unveil a set of campaign promises that they call their contract with America. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
About 200 Republican challengers signed the document. They pledged to bring legislation to the floor on a balanced budget amendment, term limits, welfare reform, and other bills if they win control in November. House GOP Whip Newt Gingrich says Democrats are out of touch.
Every item in our contract is supported by 60% or more of the American people. Some of the items are supported as much as 80% of the American people. And outside Washington, this is a contract with Americans for America.
House Democrat Robert Weiss of West Virginia says it's a contract that rewards the rich.
This is not a contract for America. This sort of hit job on America's middle class is a contract on America.
Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
The United States says no progress has been made in 5 days of talks with North Korea on its nuclear weapons program, but the two sides will meet again tomorrow in Geneva. North Korea agreed last month to switch its power-generating plants to a safer nuclear technology, from which it's harder to extract weapons-grade material. But in the talks so far, North Korea has not agreed to allow international inspection of its nuclear sites. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Grant Tinker can see half his life flash before his eyes just by watching TV reruns. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, The Newhart Show, The White Shadow, St. Elsewhere, and Hill Street Blues are just some of the programs created by MTM Enterprises, the production company he co-founded in 1970 with his then-wife, Mary Tyler Moore. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, calls it the company that set the standards for quality TV. Tinker left MTM in 1981 to become the head of NBC, a job he held for 5 years. He started his TV career in 1949 as part of NBC's first executive training program. He also worked as an ad agency executive and sponsored the Dick Van Dyke Show. Now he's written a memoir called Tinker in Television. The Mary Tyler Moore Show is still so popular you can see back-to-back episodes on Nick at Night. Here's how the show got started.
Well, it went back actually to CBS's appreciation of Mary and the Dick Van Dyke Show, which had gone off several years earlier. And Mary had done some movies that were okay, but were not great. And then did a try to play in New York, which didn't work. And so she was at liberty when Dick did a special for CBS. And he was exceedingly generous in giving Mary a lot to do in the special. And it sort of reminded CBS of how talented she was. And out of that came what we call a series commitment for 13 shows. I was at the time at Fox Television. And I left Fox to set up a company, really, based on that order for 13 shows. And fortunately, the show worked, stayed on, and then we added shows from there. So it really was, we founded the company on the basis of the show.
You brought together James Brooks and Alan Burns to write the show. What were some of the first ideas they came up with?
I can only remember one of them, which had to do with a stringer for a gossip columnist. That may be not quite accurate, but something like that. It didn't sing, and CBS didn't love it either. And luckily, they dropped it, came back, and then came up with what became the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Well, she was initially supposed to be divorced, wasn't she?
Yeah, that was sort of silly, I thought, because CBS resisted that a lot. I mean, it literally said things like, people will think she's divorced from Rob Petrie. And we solved that problem with them by agreeing, okay, she wouldn't be divorced. She will be coming off a failed affair, or at the end of an affair, and we even saw that guy in the pilot when she sort of brushed him off. So they preferred a failed affair to divorce, strangely, I thought.
How did the network feel about a single working woman?
Oh, I didn't have any problem with that concept. They did have a lot of problems when we did the show, which came off very well, the pilot when we finally did it. They did research, as networks always do, and they found all kinds of things wrong, as research frequently does. They found Mary Richards was a loser, and Rhoda Morgenstern was, I don't know whether they used the word ethnic or New York, but they didn't like her, and Phyllis Lindstrom, Cloris Leachman, was abrasive. all the things that made the show as it proceeded bothered them in terms of their research. But we got sort of famous for resisting network suggestions, and we were able to maintain what we had.
How did you know when it was time to end the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Well, it was just the family. It does become a family when you do one of those multiple camera shows in front of an audience, and you live together all day long. And I don't know, maybe the lesson of the Dick Van Dyke Show, which Carl Reiner and Sheldon Leonard and Dick decided to end after 5 years, perhaps that was in our minds. But we had done seven. I think the creative people, all of whom stayed from the beginning to the end, were looking to move on to other things, and I think Mary felt that that was enough. And from my standpoint, as the guy running the business, we had more than enough episodes to go into syndication.
How many did you need to go into syndication?
Well, about 100. In those days, with anything less than that, you didn't sell as well as if you had more.
Did you think that in 1994 it would be running in prime time on a cable station?
I don't think I did. I was always very proud of that show on behalf of the company, and as I've already said, I didn't produce it. It's my favorite MTM show, and we made some very good other shows. But I actually didn't know that it would be almost a cult show. Sort of a comedy Star Trek, and they've run the sprocket holes out of those episodes on Nickelodeon and other places.
Now, Hill Street Blues, when you had the pilot episode for that, the pilot tested negative, and you even reprint some of the notes in your book.
Right.
So what was wrong with Hill Street Blues, according to the research?
Oh, the pandemonium in the cop house bothered them, which, as you may, at least I remember, as being part of what was entertaining about the show. The fact that Ferrillo, played by Daniel Trevanti, was not... didn't seem to be in charge. The cops were kind of losers. Also, they just thought everything that turned out to be strong about the show was weak. It's very similar to the Mary situation.
Now, how was it tested? This in front of test audiences?
Yeah, they test them two ways now. They used to do it always in front of an audience, and everybody would have a box, and you turn up a thing when you like something and turn it down when you don't. Now they'll cable it out to, I don't know, maybe 3,000 homes, maybe perhaps less, and then they have reaction from it's like a focus group, but it's done electronically. And I'm not a big believer in slavishly following research. It's one of the things that's wrong with television is that if you throw the decision-making process to the research department, you're not making any instinctive, visceral judgments about programs, which are show business. And many shows that went on to become very successful would never have been seen if that had been the case. I think research is a tool, one of several, but should be used much more modestly than they frequently use it.
So how much pressure did NBC put on you to change Hill Street after it tested poorly?
I don't think so much. Fred Silverman, who had been involved in suggesting he had seen Ford Apache, a movie, it was somewhat similar. And he said, I wonder if we could do a television version of that. And Stephen Bochco and Michael Kozel created Hill Street based on that suggestion. And we went over and had meetings and said to them, this is going to be a rough show. And, we tried to warn them that they might not like everything. I don't think they were ready to sit with it all the first year, which is about what they had to do before the audience found it. They moved it around, which I'm also not an advocate of. I believe in putting a show in one place and promoting it and waiting for the audience to find it, as opposed to making them search. But at the end of that first year, the show had won a lot of Emmys, and that helped the audience find it too.
You know, Hill Street and your show Saying Elsewhere really changed the pattern of dramatic TV in the sense that there were multiple plot lines in every episode, and each episode ended without every storyline being resolved. It would be continued the next week and the week after that, and
right.
It would just, like, go on forever.
No, that's right. There were stories that arced over a number of episodes. The thing we learned, and I think Stephen, for instance, with NYPD Blue, or certainly with LA Law, has done this since, is to have one story that does end during each episode, so that there is closure for the viewer. But meanwhile, you do have three or four other situations going. It's also a way of kind of making it a viewing habit by not resolving all the stories in the episode.
Grant Tinker is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Tinker in Television. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Grant Tinker is my guest, founder of MTM Enterprises and the former head of NBC TV. Why'd you leave MTM to return to NBC and take over the company?
Well, because the chairman of RCA, the parent company of NBC, asked me to, and he caught me at a moment when I thought I couldn't match the 11 years of MTM that I'd already had. I had fond memories of my prior two terms at NBC. Knew a lot of people there, and I was very unhappy as I watched the network decline. And so all of those things gave me this feeling of wanting to help save the company, which was really going down for the third time. And I went back, and with the help of some very good colleagues, we did manage to save it. In fact, we succeeded beyond our fondest hopes.
What was the empirical evidence?
Well, both the quality shows that we were, the critical acclaim of many of our shows, some of which we've already mentioned, and the profits kept going up.
You say that the move to NBC and the move away from MTM Productions actually cost you tens of millions of dollars. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because I'm stupid. it happened because I did not seek, you know, the kind of legal advice I should have sought about putting my interest in MTM in a blind trust. It just wouldn't fly after a while, because NBC was doing business with MTM, not only on the two shows we've mentioned, but on Remington Steel and other projects were in the works. And the RCA lawyers got very nervous about that. And in effect, my choices were leave the NBC with the job undone and go back to MTM, or sell out my MTM ownership. And I did the latter. And because the company had not produced so many episodes that were to follow, and they were therefore not assets yet, I cashed out at a very low level, and the company was later sold for $320 million, and I would have had a third of that $320 million. So that's what I mean by the tens of millions of dollars.
So when Mary Tyler Moore and Newhart and now The White Shadow are on Nick at Night.
I have no interest whatsoever.
You have no financial stake in that.
As a matter of fact, the original principals of MTM don't either. Mary and two other guys to whom we gave their original interests, when they sold it to the British, they were all out. And then it's since been resold to the company that Pat Robertson runs.
Boy, if I were lucky enough to have produced those shows, I'd feel heartsick if I didn't own an interest in them anymore.
Well, the truth is, I'm human too, and I don't, but maybe not heartsick, but it took me a while to get over a sort of an anger that I had that I'd that I'd worked very hard and we'd succeeded very well, and that I didn't didn't participate in the results. But, you know, life goes on, and I'm still proud of all of the successful shows we made.
I guess you're not broke anyways, right?
No, I'm still eating.
Right. So when you got to NBC to head the company, what were the problems you perceived and how did you try to fix them?
Well, morale was one. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just very sick of losing. And so we addressed that by having a bunch of company meetings, you know, in person and connected by satellite to all the other locations, just letting people blow off steam, ask questions, you know, make complaints and so on. And we began to, I think, get back a sort of a family feeling that I remembered at NBC in earlier days. And then we began, well, at first, by the way, the first couple of years, we didn't do much at all. We neatened it up and maybe cut some losses, but our programs weren't that successful. And then we began to get successful. And as I say in the book, success begets more in television, because if you have a show like Cosby, you can put something behind it, and that show will almost automatically succeed because the audience flows into it. And as we got what we call building blocks like that, we did build other shows, and pretty soon we had a very successful network and a quality one, because we had recruited mostly quality producers.
You left NBC after it was taken over by GE.
Well, not for that reason, though. I'm careful in the book to say that. I told Thornton Bradshaw, the chairman of RCA, when I took the job, that I would give it 5 years. And I was coming to the end of my 5 years. In fact, I came to the end of it in July of 86. GE, just prior to that, had bought the company. So I stayed a little longer through the transition period and the Washington approvals and other things that were necessary. But I was going to be gone, GE or no GE.
I want to go back to your very early days in television. When you started, television programs were actually being produced by advertising agencies. So what was your job?
Not really many produced, Terry, by advertising agencies, but commissioned by advertising agencies. And they selected and bought the shows, but creative people produced them. Those creative people weren't employees of the agencies for the most part.
So what kind of jobs did you have with the ad agencies?
Well, very similar to the one I would have in the 60s at NBC. Take the Van Dyke Show. We had as a client at Benton & Bowles, Procter & Gamble, which had a lot of products to advertise, and which underwrote a number of shows. They wanted to own them and therefore have them succeed and be available to sell their products. And we took them the Carl Reiner script for the Van Dyke Show. We persuaded them that this was potentially a good show. And then part of my job was to shepherd it through. And I don't mean I did it alone, but part of Benton & Bowles' job was to follow through with that and have the creative people, Carl and Sheldon Leonard and others, make the pilot of that show for Procter & Gamble. And so, in effect, I was doing the same job that a network guy does now when he orders a program.
You met Mary Tyler Moore, to whom you were married for about 11 years, through the Dick Van Dyke Show.
18 years.
18 years, excuse me.
Terry,
thank you. You were with the company, I guess, for 11 years.
Right.
Okay. So how did you meet her?
I met her when we did the pilot of the Van Dyke Show. Laura Petrie had, nobody had really thought too much about that because, you know, the star was going to be Rob Petrie, and Mary was cast as Laura Petrie, almost by a lucky accident. Danny Thomas had once read her to play his daughter, and she didn't get the part because Danny said no one would believe she's my daughter with a nose like that, hers being quite different from his, and when Sheldon and Carl were looking for and not finding Laura Petrie, Danny happened into the office one day and said, "What about that girl with the three names?" And so they called Mary in, and the result was her being cast as Laura Petrie, which that she did, so, I think, so much better and so much more completely and so much more comedically than they had hoped, that it became a more balanced show between office and home. And she really made it. Obviously, I'm a suspect source to make this comment, but I think she made a huge contribution to that show.
So when you fell in love and decided to get married, was there anything awkward for you about being professionally involved in a program that your now wife was the star of?
Not at all, because I was at NBC in Burbank, and Mary was doing the show in Hollywood for CBS. So we were, in terms of work, we were entirely separate. She went one way, and I went the other in the morning.
What were the pros and cons for you of being a business partner with your spouse?
Well, there were no cons, actually. The pros were, one, we succeeded. The show did work, and we were able to found the company on the basis of that show, as I said. And the other one was that Mary, who is a very bright lady, she likes to do her work. And so she left the company, the business, to me. And I don't mean she wasn't aware of what was going on, but she it was not her preoccupation as it was mine. And so that was very happy. I'm not sure that's always the case where you're partnered with somebody in a company. It doesn't mean I would never ask her, what do you think of this actor, or a question to which she brought some expertise, but she didn't try to look over my shoulder and run the company, and that's, a pro for sure.
And when you separated, did it make it difficult for business?
Well, it made it, yeah, it certainly was awkward. We had a trial separation that I remember is more awkward than the final permanent one. It was 3 or 4 months, and she was still doing her show and driving on and off the lot, and my hours were longer than hers, so I would see her come and go. And yeah, it was sort of that. I remember that as difficult, and I think she does too. But then when we finally packed it in as a marriage, her show had been long since done, was over, and so she retained her interest in the company, that is her financial interest. But there was no connection.
Must be so strange for you to, I don't know if you watch Nick at Night a lot. I know I have it on a lot. And it's always the Dick Van Dyke Show and the Mary Tyler Moore Show. It must be so strange for you to have part of your life so frequently represented on television.
Well, I don't watch it a lot. I don't know why. Yes, I do know why. I sort of deplore what happened to the company after I left. And I don't really want to get into that, except I thought it was very badly handled by people that I had brought into the company and convinced Mary could run it. A couple of very bad choices, and for that reason, because of the bad taste in my mouth about the company beyond my own presence there, I don't run to watch the shows, which doesn't mean I don't watch some of them, and I'm happy that Mary and I have a very good, friendly relationship. But I tend to look at a rerun of Hill Street, I think, before I would look at some of the comedies.
Do you wish you were? Are you working in TV now?
No, I'm not, and it's a problem. I'm not ready to go to Forest Lawn, but once you run things, it's very hard to go back and be a cog in the machine. Not that anyone's particularly begged me to do so. So I'm sort of standing back and trying to find a big picture that I could get involved in, but not desperately.
Grant Tinker, his new memoir is called Tinker in Television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Patrice Gaines is a reporter for The Washington Post, but as a young woman, she turned her back on her middle-class upbringing and hung out with young men who toted guns and got their money through robberies. She did time for heroin possession. Now she sees her own story in the lives of the young black women she writes about. We'll talk with her about her new memoir, Laughing in the Dark, From Colored Girl to Woman of Color, A Journey from Prison to Power. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Workers have gone on strike against General Motors at a Flint, Michigan plant. The walkout is part of a series of labor disputes at GM plants in the past year. Don Gagne reports from Flint.
United Auto Workers Local 599 is the largest in the entire GM system, and it has shut down GM's massive Buick complex in Flint in a dispute over employment levels, overtime, and other health and safety issues. The complex, sometimes called Buick City, builds Buicks and Oldsmobiles, but also parts, which are shipped to GM plants around the world. Union leaders say the company needs to hire more workers to keep up with demand in a booming market. The company says it needs to keep costs and employment levels down, preferring overtime and the hiring of some temporary workers. The effects of the strike elsewhere will be felt soon. Some say 100,000 workers could be laid off within 2 days because of parts shortages. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Flint.
A Pentagon spokesman says the American soldier found shot to death in the northern part of Haiti's capital appears to have committed suicide, but the spokesman says the man's death is being investigated. The Pentagon says the man was part of the 10th Mountain Division from Fort Drum, New York. His identity has not been released. A spokesman says he cannot discuss why military officials think that the gunshot wound that killed the soldier was self-inflicted. The soldier was the first American to die in Haiti since the occupation began. The Coast Guard says another 172 Haitian refugees are scheduled to return to Haiti today. This is the second group of refugees from the Guantanamo Bay detention camp who are being repatriated since the U.S. occupation of Haiti. The Coast Guard says, like the first group, the returning Haitians all volunteered to go back. Criminal charges have been filed against a former French Minister of Social Affairs in connection with the distribution of AIDS-tainted blood. Four medical officials have already been convicted. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French hemophiliacs have been trying for 5 years to bring charges against three former cabinet ministers who were in office in 1985 when the contaminated blood was distributed, and now they had their first success. Former Minister of Social Affairs, Georgina Dufoy, was charged with complicity in poisoning. And later this week, the former Minister of Health and former Prime Minister, Laurent Fabius, will also be charged with complicity in poisoning. All three say they're innocent of any wrongdoing. The hemophiliacs say the ministers were responsible because they neglected to buy safe blood products and authorize an AIDS screening test. The hemophiliacs say the government was slow to act because it was more interested in business than human lives. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Stocks closed mixed again today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 14 points, but declining issues led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR News. The judge in the O.J. Simpson trial says finding jurors is not proving to be as hard as he had feared. Judge Lance Ito has been going through answers that potential jurors have provided on their questionnaires and excusing those who say they can't serve for 3 to 6 months. The judge has been talking in person to people who say they might be able to serve and is finding it easier to assemble a group of 250 finalists from which to choose 12 jurors and 8 alternates. Japan's trade minister is heading to Washington today for a last-ditch effort at heading off U.S. trade sanctions against his country. Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
With time ticking away, Japan's trade minister, Lotaro Hashimoto, abruptly decided to travel to Washington, where he's expected to meet with U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor. Hashimoto's ministry is in charge of the talks on automobiles and commercial glass, two of the four areas at issue in the 14-month-old talks. His last-minute visit, though, seems aimed more at persuading Washington not to impose sanctions than in actually reaching an agreement. Both sides say they are far apart, and it appears unlikely they'll resolve their differences by Friday, the day the U.S. will either declare the dispute settled or slap on sanctions. And Ambassador Walter Mondale warned yesterday, if there's no agreement on Japanese government purchases of foreign supplies, sanctions would surely follow. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
President Clinton and Russian President Yeltsin have opened their two-day summit at the White House. Romania's female gymnasts apparently are not being treated like stars as they were under communist rule, and they've gone on strike for better pay. Their coach says they're boycotting their training sessions because they have not been paid cash bonuses that they had been promised for doing well at international events in the spring. Among those participating in the walkout is Olympic medalist Lavinia Milosevic, who's quoted as saying, "I can't work for years and years for nothing." I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a reporter for The Washington Post, Patrice Gaines has written about young girls in trouble. Their lives often remind her of her own. She remembers visiting boyfriends in jail and doing time herself for possession of heroin. She was abused by the men she loved and for years didn't have much luck in breaking the cycle. These were the parts of her past she kept hidden when she joined The Washington Post. But in 1992, she wrote an autobiographical piece for the paper that was very well received. This enabled her to start speaking publicly about her life. Now she's written a memoir called Laughing in the Dark. She hopes the book reaches the young girls who are largely silent victims. The media, Gaines says, often overlooks the girls while covering their boyfriends. Here's a reading that helps explain why, as a young woman, Gaines was attracted to trouble.
When I was old enough to want a man of my own, I chose young men who toted guns, burglarized houses, robbed stores, and pulled flim-flams. They were survivors, tough boys who said, "Damn the white man and his ways." They made up their own rules and took what they wanted. When my school bus rolled past their corner, I stared out the window at them swaggering and laughing, wearing the same clothes they had worn the day before because their night was just ending. I could smell their brazenness, their raw guts that I misinterpreted as power. When you're a black child in America, your inclination is to feel powerless, and you will, in fact, lack power unless someone intervenes to teach you how to possess it. I had already bought into powerlessness. Being a black girl child meant I had about as much influence in the world as there was in my itty-bitty finger, or as much as I saw my mother hold in our family. I grabbed hold of these young men who other people called thugs, hustlers, or hoodlums. They were my power and my freedom. What did I know about the power within me?
I'd like to hear more about why you think as a young woman you were attracted to men whose power came from guns and drugs and stealing.
Well, I think it had to do with my being black, but it had also to do with my father. My father was a very patriotic, he was a military man in the Marine Corps, and I looked at him as representing what America represented to me at that time. And this would have been like the 50s, early 60s when I was growing up. And to me, America represented a very racist society where I felt totally powerless. And I felt that my father helped uphold, you know, that kind of oppression against me. And therefore, I wanted someone totally different from him, a more in-your-face kind of person. I guess I would have considered my father, and did consider him, an Uncle Tom. So I wanted a different kind of black man.
Did the men you were attracted to have a political rhetoric that gave some kind of political justification to what they were doing?
I think it may be a mild, we seldom talked politics, but when we did, it was generally just against the white man, nothing specific. It was always to blame the white man, the racist society. But we certainly didn't get into the dynamics of politics and didn't, you know, get into changing things the way other young people were.
The men you were attracted to were not only doing things that were illegal and might have had a certain kind of power and mystery attracted to them, but these were also men who mistreated you. Maybe I should just ask you about, for instance, the first man who you write about, Ben. He was your first real boyfriend. He was the father of your daughter. How did he treat you?
Ben was often verbally abusive, but he certainly slept around. You know, it was not faithful as I was, this young teenage faithful girlfriend. So he wasn't faithful to me. I ended up catching syphilis from him. And, you know, just that was a very abusive relationship in that way. And, of course, he ended up turning me on to heroin, to drugs. And that, of course, was the greatest abuse of all.
You were 18 when you got pregnant and had your daughter. You weren't married to Ben. And I guess I'm wondering what your reaction was about becoming a mother at that age. Were you... did you feel ready for it? Did you want to be a mother yet?
Well, it's funny. I never was afraid and never was sorry that I was pregnant. From the time I found out I was pregnant, I was happy. I mean, I was scared only because I would have to tell my parents, but I wasn't afraid of being a mother. But I think that's because I really had no idea what it meant. And my mother had seven children, and it all looked to me that it was pretty easy for her. And so I really, you know, had no idea about the responsibilities. Certainly didn't think about, you know, how was I going to take care of this child, not just physically, financially, what was her future going to be? I mean, at that age, I didn't even know what my own was. And so it was nothing planned, and I was happy.
Mm-hmm. You were arrested and convicted when you were, I don't know, I guess around 20, for possession of heroin. You were holding it for Ben, and you were at a concert with him, and he ended up selling to undercover narcotics agents who knew that you were with him, and they came and got you. So there you were in prison, a young woman, and it must have been a scary experience.
Well, yeah, now that was pretty frightening, because even with all of the things that I had done that one would consider dangerous, I certainly never even considered that I could get caught and end up in jail. I mean, that was just, no one in my family had ever been to jail, so I didn't know anyone other than these guys. They talk about jail, but they were in and right out. And so I knew nothing about jail, and that was really, it was very frightening. It made me stop, you know, for the first time in my life and consider what I was doing and where I was going.
Your family got you out of prison by putting their house up for the bond, and you were given 5 years probation instead of 5 years in prison. It sounds from your description in the book like that was something of a crisis for you, because on the one hand, this is the family who you'd rebelled against. On the other hand, it was their middle-classness that bailed you out.
Exactly, and even... it was specifically my father who was able to do it because of the fact that he was middle class and had worked and did purchase a house. And so that I had to rely upon everything that I had rebelled against, including my father, to get me out.
So did that change your feelings about your family at all?
Well, it certainly, you know, it changed them somewhat. I still had a lot of anger against my father, and I didn't realize for years that it was anger. But I was angry with him for not being there for me in a lot of other cases, you know, for even not being there to come and visit me when I was in jail, for, you know, not being there to come to school when, you know, there were programs, for just not being there for me emotionally. So I always had this anger, you know, this kind of background or underground anger that I carried against him.
Patrice Gaines is my guest. She's a reporter for The Washington Post and author of a new memoir called Laughing in the Dark. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Washington Post reporter Patrice Gaines is my guest. Her new memoir is called Laughing in the Dark, From Colored Girl to Woman of Color, A Journey from Prison to Power. I want to ask you about an incident that I think it's fair to say was a real low point in your life. You got involved with a man who other women had warned you about. He was a very flamboyant dresser and had two gold teeth, but you got into nice talks with him and everything and liked him sexually as well. I mean, one day he locked you in a room, whipped you, and then raped you, whipped you really badly.
Yeah, terribly badly. I at first did not realize or even think that he had raped me. I mean, which is what he did, because once he beat me, I was pretty almost lifeless and unable, you know, to move myself. And so then he had sex with me. And I wasn't sure it was rape, because this is some time ago, and certainly the word, the phrase date rape had never even been mentioned, and I had dated this guy. But I did know that he had beaten me severely, and that was totally unacceptable. And yet I was afraid to go to the police because of my previous record, because of my background. So I hesitated to go to the police until a girlfriend said, you know, you've got to go. And that was after she looked at how badly he had beaten me. And when I went to the police, they also were a little reluctant to believe me, or seemed disinterested, until I told them about the beating. And they had a woman police officer go into the bathroom with me and look at my wounds. And when she described them to them, and also she took Polaroid pictures, and when she described them and they saw the pictures, well, then the men, the police officers, were outraged. And it always struck me, you know, just as a sign of those times, that they seemed more outraged about the beating than actually about the rape. But they did go out after that to look for him, and I must admit that I prayed that they wouldn't catch him, because I just didn't think that I had the strength or whatever it took to go through a trial like that.
Did they catch him?
No, they never did. They never did. He left town, and I was just happy that he had left, and really happy to end that chapter, you know, to not have to go to court and not have to have my whole reputation dragged out. I had very little, I did not believe at all that they would find him guilty during this age. I didn't believe that they would find a black man guilty of raping a black woman who he had dated, you know, a woman, period, who had dated someone and then this person had raped her. And on top of that, a woman with a reputation as mine. I just did not believe it. And so I didn't want to put myself through that.
You write in your book that you thought of yourself as the perfect victim for men. Was there a point where you said, I'm not going to be a victim anymore?
Yeah, I think there was. But I really think that that's been even in more recent years. I mean, I decided not to be a victim in lots of ways over the years. But I think what happened was maybe I traded one form of being a victim, one kind of victimization for another, so that I knew I was not going to allow myself to be physically abused. But I think sometimes we allow ourselves to be abused in ways that, you know, we can fool ourselves and try to rationalize and say, we're not being abused. So that I dated men who maybe cheated on me, or who disrespected me in ways where it was simply just to say I'll be there at a certain time and didn't show up, or they lied. Well, then that's abuse also. So I think it was only probably 5 years ago that I said, never, not even that, not even a little lie, you know, nothing against me is going to be admissible. I won't allow it.
What do you think changed in you?
Well, I think my sense of self-worth, I think that it went up and up and up as I gained different successes, and as also I learned to just accept myself and not blame myself so much, to forgive myself, really. I would forgive other people so easily and would not forgive myself, so that I still considered myself, you know, the bad kid in my family, the bad daughter, I thought I was the bad mother, even though I thought that was the only thing I could do right. I would find ways to say, well, look, you know, I did this wrong. And I was always beating up on myself. So I think finally, a little slowly but surely, each year, I learned to accept myself. I saw that my daughter was a mentally healthy young woman, and I thought, you know, I didn't do so bad. I saw her graduate from college, and I thought, well, now, you know, I couldn't have been so horrible. And I had successes on my job, in my career. And so finally, I just, I learned to love myself enough, and I went to therapy, and that helped a lot.
Patrice Gaines is my guest. Her new memoir is called Laughing in the Dark, From Colored Girl to Woman of Color, A Journey from Prison to Power. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the General Motors strike?
Terry, so far it's a walkout at one Buick plant and is apparently over local issues, but could spread to other plants, or the effects could, because they make parts there. So we'll be covering that story from Detroit. We also have from Haiti Alan Tomlinson on the program for turning in guns for financial reward. And Alan will be looking into the first death of an American in Haiti and apparent suicide. We have an interview with Jerry Adams of Sinn Féin. We have an obituary for health care with the American people talking about what they think it means.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Patrice Gaines. Her new memoir is called Laughing in the Dark. She's a reporter for the Washington Post and often writes about the inner city. You wrote an article about a shooting, and it was the boy who got shot was a close friend of your nephew's, and in fact your nephew was grazed by bullets in this shooting. And I read that article in the context of knowing the romance that you had about men with guns when you were a young woman.
Yes.
And I was just thinking about how much your thinking must have changed about that.
Oh, yes. I think aging is a wonderful process.
Yeah, really.
which I often look at young people who I write about who die, say, at age 21 and 22. And, what is written about them is how horrible they are because of the life they lived to that point. And I think if I had died at that age, that would be my obituary. And what would be theirs if they could have lived 10 more years? And so I try not to judge them so harshly. But it was to be able to change to the point, even where I have these experiences and these thoughts, I think, that incident with my nephew, it just brought home the stories that I write about. And there's nothing like a personal experience to make the teaching stay and hold fast forever.
What happened to your nephew?
Well, he's a wonderful kid now, and he's recovered at least physically the scars. But he was standing in front of a church, sitting on the steps of a church, actually. It's a church on the corner near where I used to live. And he was sitting there in the evening with some of his friends. And they often hang out on the corner because these are small row houses, and there's really nobody who has a large enough space for these tall teenage boys, you know, with these long legs. And so they would hang out there, and he was sitting there with some friends and with a very good friend, Hank. And a guy walked past them and started firing into the crowd, and Hank was killed. And Hank was a kid who was getting ready to go to college and had a promising future and was loved and respected by everyone in the neighborhood. And the word on the street was that it was mistaken identity, that this guy was looking for someone else. But you know, my nephew saw this, and I often wonder, you know, I mean, what is it like to live with seeing your good friend shot in the head, you know, and watching him fall dead right at your feet? I just don't know. I know that there are scars that we'll never see.
What kind of stories do you like to write about now?
Well, I do. I like to write about kind of redemption stories, as I call them. I like to write about people who have overcome all kinds of challenges, not necessarily the type that I have overcome, but just have changed their lives. Like most recently, I wrote about a woman who took $5,500 of her personal savings and started a community center for kids and doesn't have even money to pay herself. But people who do things that I, quite frankly, don't even do and wouldn't. And I don't have, you know, whatever it takes within my spirit to do it. And yet I admire them so, and I think it helps us to all know, to know that they exist.
I may be wrong, but it's my impression that there are more stories like yours being told now from the male point of view than the female point of view.
Oh, I think that's definitely true, and has been for quite a while. I think as the role of women and changes and what we expect and how we see women, we're feel freer to tell our stories. For instance, I know I was still reluctant to talk about sex because I think a lot of men still think of women as not being able to have these full sexual lives and certainly not to be promiscuous. And I was afraid, you know, that whole thing. And whereas men will write about this, they'll write about their aggression and it's expected. I think it's almost respected in a way that they would act out their anger in these aggressive ways. Even if people say, you know, tish, 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 they still seem to enjoy reading it. And yet, I was afraid, you know, I'd be called whore, slut, and all kinds of words still. And so I hope, too, that by telling my story, it would free up a lot of women to tell theirs, because there's so many young girls who desperately need to hear them.
You know something else that I think might be harder for you to tell? Your male counterpart would be in the position of being the aggressor, both
yes.
sexually and in terms of,
yes.
you know, doing illegal things, robbing stores or whatever. You are in the position of often being the victim.
Yes.
And not even being the victim of, like, white society, but being a victim of your own boyfriend, of your black boyfriend.
Exactly.
And that's writing more out of, I think writing out of being victimized is maybe more difficult than writing out of remembering when you were strutting and aggressive and, you know, sticking it to society.
Well, it's true, because even my editor said to me, and it was a concern, people aren't going to read, you know, you have to be careful. They're going to get tired of reading about you being victimized, because we don't like victims. We want them to get over it. We want them to recover and straighten mm-hmm. out their lives. And we don't understand, you know, why are they so stupid and why do they keep doing this? And yet we'll ride along, so to say, we'll watch as a man acts out his aggression. And I think, you know, our stories, as I say it, our stories just aren't respected as much. And even in the media, I found myself writing more about men than about the young women, which is, you know, why I wanted to do this, because they were the silent people, and yet their lives are profoundly affected by those same things that affect the lives of the men.
Patrice Gaines is a reporter for The Washington Post. Her new memoir is called Laughing in the Dark. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the dark Avenger and Hellraiser of cyberspace. We talk with Corey Sandler, contributing editor of PC Computing Magazine, about his investigation of the computer world's most notorious pranksters and villains, the people who write computer viruses. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.